Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Danny Granger from the Indiana Pacers. You're listening to the Average Joe Sports Show.
March Madness. The time when I have an excuse to be angry all the time. Ahoy, everybody. Welcome aboard. It's the Average Joe Sports Show here on the Sports Geeks Radio Network. Joel Cordes with you on this Sunday evening and beyond, for those of you who will hear this in archive fashion. Big, big show planned, as always. Speaking of that March Madness stuff, I think we'll have some tournament games to talk about. NFL free agency, the hot stove keeps cooking hotter over in the National Football League. We'll talk about Peyton Manning, Matt Flynn, lots of different signings. We've got a couple of big guests coming up on the program here today as well. Aaron Nadler from BleacherReport.com, NFL lead blogger, and Michael Felder, a college football lead writer over in those parts of the woods, will be joining us here in just a little bit as well. We'll talk some NBA, of course. The NBA trade deadline just concluded this past week. A fair number of moves, although not always the ones expected. Ethan Noroff and I will break those down as well. Speaking of Ethan Noroff, let's welcome him to the program once more. Hi, Ethan. How are you doing?
Doing well. It's always a pleasure to be on with you, Joel.
And then the guy who puts the mad in March Madness for me, Michael Schotte, joins us at this moment. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
And leave on the phone lines. Let's make this quartet complete. Aaron Nagler from BleacherReport.com, new NFL blogger, joins us as well. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well. Thanks a lot for having me on.
All right. Let's talk some NFL free agency stuff to begin with here. Aaron, I'm going to start with you. Satiate our desire for 24/7 Peyton Manning coverage. What's the latest, and are we sick of this yet?
I get the sense people are starting to get sick of it. I don't think we've gotten anywhere close to far of annoyance levels yet, but people are definitely starting to tire of it. And, you know, it's easy on the outside to get, you know, quote-unquote sick of all the coverage. That's a media creation. You know, as far as Peyton Manning is concerned, he needs to take the time that he needs to figure out what he wants to do. I certainly don't hold that against him, but I have no doubt that people are getting a little tired. I saw a couple tweets from players today actually saying how tired they were of turning on SportsCenter and seeing nothing but Manning coverage. So I can understand people getting, you know, tired of it because, you know, it's a humongous story. But, you know, indications are he should have a decision made in the next day or two. So hopefully that comes to pass and we get to talk about his new location.
Mike Schotte, it seems like Miami is for sure out of the running. Arizona's for sure out of the running. That news is come and gone at this point. The new dark horse candidate, of course, over the past few days has been the San Francisco 49ers, who appear to be, at least from my perspective, appear to be sprinting out to the front on this, though the Denver Broncos remain in play. Tell me who still is in the running and where you see Peyton signing.
Yeah, I think the two teams you listed are probably 1 and then 2A, San Francisco being number 1, Denver being 2A. I think 2B, very close behind the Broncos, is the Tennessee Titans. They want Peyton Manning, and that's from the ownership on down. And they are literally willing to do anything within their power to get him, offering him things like lifetime contract, you know, with a position in the front office after he retires, or possibly even giving Archie Manning and Peyton a ownership stake in the team to sweeten the pot even more. They're literally willing to throw out all the stops. And so it's always possible that financially the Titans could swoop in and, you know, make an impact. But Peyton Manning with the Titans still doesn't really make them, I don't want to say not a playoff contender, because I think they would be a contender if Manning is healthy, but they've still got the Texans in the way. And so then you look at, he could go to Denver and have a pretty easy shot at getting to the AFC or winning the AFC West crown again. The Denver Broncos did it last year with Tebow under center. And if he goes to the San Francisco 49ers, this is a team that was a Super Bowl contender last year, had a chance to go deep in the playoffs and, you know, beat a lot of good teams en route to, you know, getting back to the playoffs with Alex Smith under center. So I truly think the two teams you listed, both the Denver Broncos and the San Francisco 49ers, are the two teams that in the end are going to be weighing heavily on Manning's mind. Because let's be honest, money means nothing to Manning. He's made many hundreds of millions of dollars already in his NFL career, and that's not even counting all the endorsement deals that he has and will continue to have because he's such a successful pitchman. So he's looking to win, and he's looking to win right away because he knows he doesn't have that much time left.
Aaron, the San Francisco Chronicle and ESPN are both reporting that Alex Smith has been meeting with the Dolphins quite a bit here in the last 24 hours. Reports have been a five-hour meeting as of right now. It's no given, obviously, that the Niners are going to get Peyton Manning. How big of a detriment would it be to the Niners if they burn their bridges with Alex Smith, who was a very, very respectable player for them last season?
Yeah, that's got a lot of moving parts, that whole story. I mean, you talk about, you know, his dalliance with Miami, and yeah, he's in Miami today, and you know, I saw one headline saying that he's actually negotiating terms. I mean, anything could happen. The thing is if, you know, the one thing that's gone unsaid so far, at least on this program, is, you know, Tom Condon's involvement. As far as his representing Peyton Manning, his representing Alex Smith, his representing tons of, you know, the elite quarterback class in the NFL, Condon and the 49ers may have had some kind of, you know, backhanded agreement, you know, but it's kind of shadow deal to, you know, we're going to try and get Manning, but we don't want to let Alex know until the last minute, so let's do it this way. Now Alex Smith, you know, there's rumblings that he's going to fire Condon. That all is obviously all is yet to play out, but what's interesting to me is if Alex Smith does go through with this and say, let's say he signs with the Dolphins, you know, who lost out on Matt Flynn this afternoon, let's say that happens, and then Manning chooses either Denver or Tennessee, well, then the 49ers have no choice but to start the Colin Kaepernick era, which I don't think would be terrible. I mean, you know, he looked, you know, shaky at best in preseason last year, but now he's got a full season under his belt. He could come into the camp as the unquestioned starter, but I don't think that's where, you know, that's not the route that the Niners want to take, especially if he's got this close to getting Peyton Manning, who you have to think makes them an early Super Bowl contender if he does sign.
Let me hop in here, Joel. I think that one of the things that has been also understated is not only how good Alex Smith was last year, but really Alex Smith has been with this franchise since being drafted number one overall and has had to go through a lot. You know, multiple scheme changes, having to deal with Mike Martz's offensive coordinator. They've always had a pretty poor receiving core around him and not a great offensive line in front of him. He's been through a lot, and really the one year where there was any consistency, he shined. And so while, yes, he's probably, you know, can still be considered a bust as a number one overall pick, he was a very steady quarterback last year, and to throw that aside to really gamble on Peyton Manning having any sort of impact, not only from the neck surgeries, but also just age. He's 36 years old. He might not have that much left, even if he was healthy. So, I mean, they're taking a gamble either way, whether or not Alex Smith goes elsewhere or not. If they basically say Peyton Manning over Alex Smith, that could go horribly no matter what else happens.
Aaron, let me throw this your way. Let's just follow the footsteps here. With Smith being in Miami, the reason why the Dolphins are interested in Alex Smith is because, as you mentioned, they lose out on Matt Flynn, who signs with Seattle Seahawks today. who's the bigger prize, I guess? Could it be a blessing in disguise if Miami winds up with Smith instead of Flynn? And how do you see Flynn faring in Seattle at this point?
Well, I think the good part for Flynn being in Seattle with that offense is you've got Marshawn Lynch behind him. You know, they're going to run the ball. They're going to play defense. They're not going to. It's not going to be an aerial show like, you know, he was running in that one start he had last year in Green Bay. I know Michael is no Flynn fan, so I'm not gonna sing his praises too much. But I think Matt Flynn's a better quarterback than Alex Smith. I know Alex Smith has got a ton of experience, and I know he's been a pro about everything that he's gone through. But I think watching Matt Flynn breaking down both of his starts, you know, everybody is aware of the limitations of his arm. You know, he can't make the deep 15-yard, 20-yard comeback throws on the opposite side of the field. But that's about his only limitation. The guy, you know, sets the protections perfectly. He's great at making something out of nothing when things break down. And, you know, you look at the state of quarterback play around the NFL, that's a valuable commodity because these offensive lines aren't as cohesive as they used to be. You know, there's a lot more call for, you know, being able to improvise, which Flynn can do. He's done it again and again. You saw it in the Detroit start. You saw it in the New England start. I think that's a real get for Seattle. What I love is Pete Carroll coming out today and saying that Matt Flynn is going to compete with Tarvaris Jackson for the starting job. That to me is laughable, but we'll see. I'm sure Pete has his reasons.
Mike, as usual, we spend 90% of the time on the quarterbacks, in this case three of them, and so we've got 10% of the time left over. give me a couple of the other names that have notably moved on. We've had a couple of mid-tier receivers that have signed. Give me just a couple of the rumors that are out there and what's the latest.
Yeah, I think of guys who have recently signed, and I'll try to stay pretty recent here. Mario Manningham made some waves yesterday when he, or early this morning, one or the other, signed with the San Francisco 49ers again. People are thinking that with bringing Manningham in, maybe Manning is next. He gives them a good receiving option simply from the Z receiver position. Crabtree, even though he's not a number one in terms of targets and production, is still a good X receiver. With Manningham able to work underneath, and Vernon Davis, who is a number one in terms of targets and production, able to work from the Y/tight end position, they're going to have a pretty decent offense no matter who's under center. They've improved their total package from last year, and that's a little bit scary for these other teams in the NFC West. Another wide receiver, Brandon Lloyd, has one job now that he's a New England Patriot. He has to get loose deep. So they've had guys recently like Deion Branch and later on Randy Moss who couldn't ignite that same spark that Randy Moss did a few years ago when this was a record-setting offense. It's really not even about getting open deep. It's just about having that option, the ability to throw it up and have Brandon Lloyd go get it, even if he's on Revis Island. That is going to keep offenses backpedaling when they should be attacking and give Tom Brady a lot more room to work with guys like Welker, Edelman, and possibly Anthony Gonzalez, who recently signed. In terms of guys who are still out there, another wide receiver, Ted Ginn, is meeting with the Lions and the Baltimore Ravens, or already met with, I should say. He's a guy who's probably a top five returner in the league and a solid wide receiver if you're looking for a number three, number four, again, in terms of production. He's not going to be a world beater for you, but he wants to be a solid part of the offense, and that's just not what he was in San Francisco, and they've obviously moved on with their acquisitions. A couple defensive guys. Reggie Nelson was just signed by the Bengals. I really like that move. He's not a huge impact guy, but he's a guy whose name you should know more than a lot of people do. Joe Mays, linebacker for the Denver Broncos, is really the first linebacker off the board. He goes back to his team, the Broncos, leaving guys like David Hawthorne meeting with the Lions. Steven Tulloch, who hasn't met with anyone but is apparently asking for the biggest contract. Curtis Lofton is meeting with the Saints, could replace Vilma there, and a host of other guys. We've really yet to see this linebacker market shake out, and that could be the biggest storyline going into next week.
Well, as always, guys, we are out of time here now for NFL stuff. Aaron Nagler from BleacherReport.com, lead writer over there. Everybody check his stuff. That's at BleacherReport.com. Aaron, thanks so much for joining us on the program. We will be sure to do this again sometime.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot for having me, guys.
All right. It's time to take a break, my friends. When we come back on the Average Joe Sports Show here on the Sports Geeks Radio Network, we'll talk a little college football / NFL draft. Another newbie over at BleacherReport.com. This will be Michael Felder, the college football lead writer over there, new on the job. He joins us as well. You don't want to miss it. Plus, we, of course, have March Madness to talk about, NBA news and notes. The trade deadline is gone and passed, and lots of different moves to talk about. Noroff will be jumping back in with that, too. We'll be right back. This is the Average Joe Sports Show here on the Sports Geeks Radio Network.
You think I have nothing better to do than gather information on you and use it against you? Do you think I'm that petty?
Oh, of course not.
Oh, and by the way, you're not working hard enough.
What?
Yep, got it all on this tape right here. For everyone's safety and security, and to preserve our way of life, I'm taking a drastic step and putting up a security camera. Just one. For safety, security, and omniscient, unblinking information gathering of everyone's activities. I can't believe I'm hearing this. Wait a minute, let me rewind. Now get out of here. I have to go back to reading everyone's emails over the PA system.
Hey, welcome back. It's the Average Joe Sports Show here on the Sports Geeks Radio Network. Joel Cordes, Michael Schotte, Ethan Noroff flying in tripartite fashion. And now we're joined on the phone lines by Michael Felder, the lead college football writer over at BleacherReport.com. First time on the program. Michael, how goes it?
I'm doing great. How are you all doing?
Fantastic. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, what you're bringing to the table now for Bleacher Report, and then we got to talk some college football and NFL draft stuff.
Like I said in the first post I did over at Bleacher Report, it was called Pro-Style Offense, Big Boy Defense, and Grit. So, Southern boy, grew up in the South. I love defense, love pro-style offense. I love the way Nick Saban and Alabama play football. But beyond that, I played a little bit of football at North Carolina, so Tar Heels are always near and dear to my heart, and I'm sure we'll talk about the whole NCAA thing in a little bit here, but just watching film and understanding what's going on in the game, and then I've got sort of found a niche in terms of the whole NCAA and the legality of things and how things worked out, so I've got those things working for me, but it's going to be that and a lot of commentary and opinion, you know, giving some thoughts for folks at the Bleacher Report.
Let's start with the legal aspect. This is a topic that seems a little far afield for this time of year, and yet this is the time of year in college football when things slow down. It was certainly a tumultuous season. You can talk about UNC. You can talk about, still residual efforts from USC, obviously the Penn State stuff that was going on. Talk to me a little bit about the scandals and sanctions. What's the deal with college football right now?
I think the system is really – ultimately what's happening is you've got something – you've got a governing body and a system that was never meant to house this sort of financial production from an economic standpoint. They are – it's too much money. And when you're dealing with too much money for something that was never meant to be a money-making entity, you're going to have problems. And there's pushback. The players are seeing pushback. The players are talking about pushback. Instead, it used to be guys that played football a long time ago and kind of the dusty, crusty old guys were talking about how the system was broken and they got used. But now it's a lot of guys that just got done playing talking about it, Ohio State guys, North Carolina guys, talking about they'd love to see the players get a little bit of extra cash and see things work out that way. But ultimately with the system and the way that it's running right now, you can only do what you can. And when you get caught, you take your medicine. North Carolina, they're going to take a 15 scholarships over 3 seasons, just 5 scholarships a year, a 1-year bowl ban. We see Ohio State giving up 9 scholarships, I believe, over 3 years with a 1-year bowl ban. When you get caught with your hand in the cookie jar, you've got to take it. And ultimately, I think the praise really goes to the writers because they're the guys that are digging this stuff up. And then the NCAA kind of comes on and, you know, drops a little, you know, slaps guys on the wrist or drops a hammer where they see fit.
Of course, during the off season, we wish that college football would really be looking at their playoff setup or lack thereof and trying to deal with the bowl situation. And yet instead during the off season like this, they're dealing with the cleanup from all the scandals. Of course, this is the time of year that even though college football is done, we have the NCAA tournament going on for basketball, both men's and women's. Everybody loves it. It's exciting. It's fantastic. And the argument always comes up, geez, I wish college football would do something like this some sort of playoff. Where do you stand in this argument?
I'm not a pro playoff guy, honestly, right now. And I understand the people falling in love with the spectacle that is March Madness. I take it for what it is. It's 3 weeks that a lot of people pay attention to college basketball, and that's fantastic. We already have 15, and then you throw in some of the bowls. We've got about 16 or 17 weeks that college football is on the forefront of most folks' minds, or at least it's second to the NFL in most people's minds. You talk about people watching the games. College football dominates college basketball in every sense of the word in that respect. So from that standpoint, I don't think that the parallels can be drawn. But for me, I look at it, and I know it's the offseason, but we are seeing the SEC has decided that they're okay with a 14 playoff. The Big Ten has decided they're okay with a 14 playoff. Pac-12 just voted last week, actually, that they're okay with 14 playoffs. So there is a little bit of a move coming. I think 14 is where you ought to keep it. 8 teams, to me, loses a bit of the exclusivity that's involved with it. It does kind of muddy the water a little bit. And I think that the 4 teams is going to give you, whether you go conference champs or you go with your top 4 teams, it's going to give you the best 4. You play those guys out and let them win instead of the idea of giving everybody else a shot. Because I think college football, in its season at its crux, the biggest thing about college football has been play through your regular season to get a chance. And then after that, let the chips fall where they may. So I think if you keep it exclusive, you keep it at that 4, basically what you're going is from a 2-team playoff, the BCS championship game, to a 4-team playoff. You give 4 teams a shot. You get the best 4 in the country and play those guys. And I think you'll still see something a bit more like a true champion as opposed to somebody who's the champion of a tournament.
I like that idea a lot. In fact, really a compromise option that mm-hmm. gives people the best of both worlds. That's a fantastic idea. Let's shift gears a little bit. Because NFL free agency is the hot topic at the moment, the combine is gone, we kind of lose track of NFL draft stuff. It really falls underneath the radar for a couple of weeks here until it really pipes up again. Are there any rumors that are out there, any speculation that you've heard, guys that you think might be rising and falling, or just guys that you're excited to see? Being the college football aficionado that you are, guys that you're excited to see where they might land when the draft finally rolls around here.
I think the biggest one is got to be RG3, just a kid that, for people that weren't following college football nearly as close as I was, he really just did explode for them this past season, winning the Heisman, taking Baylor to that great record they have, their top 10, top 15 rankings. That he did all those things, and now he's on everybody's radar. And we're seeing a team like Washington move up to make sure that they get this kid. And I think that's just really exciting for me because I've seen him grow. When he had the injury, he couldn't finish a season, and then he finally does, and we see what he can do for, 12 games. We see that this kid can really be special. So I think that's something that really gets me excited. Obviously, being the Tar Heel, I am looking at Quentin Coples because I wonder what folks think of him. I've had multiple people ask me what I thought about him and kind of try to get the inside, kind of pick his brain a little bit and see where his head's at. But I want to see where he goes because anybody that gets him is going to get a quality ball player. I think he got a bad shake this season because of the way things went down and losing his coach that he went to play for. But overall, I'm just so excited. I wonder where the kid Chris Givens from Wake Forest is going to end up. Had a great combine. He's a good wide receiver, and just getting a chance to see him play a lot. He's got an understanding in terms of body control and how to run routes and how to get open. So that's one of those guys that I look at, and I wonder where is he going to end up because he's going to help somebody. I think he's going to help them pretty soon.
Michael Schotte, this I know is something you keep your ear pretty close to the ground on as well. Any scuttlebutt that you can share with us?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of teams that need to make some moves depending on how all this quarterback free agency stuff shakes out. Don't want to belabor the quarterback market a little bit, but there's going to be a couple of guys, whether it's Brandon Whedon, the old man from Oklahoma State, will be 29 next season, or if it's Ryan Tannehill, who from Texas A&M simply hasn't shown that he's able to be an NFL caliber passer yet, but has tons of potential, those guys could be rocketing up draft boards, just like we saw last season with Ponder and Locker and Gabbert. To teams that simply didn't get their quarterbacks in free agency and don't have a franchise quarterback at the roster. It's a position that if you don't have one, you have to go get one, and we could be seeing that sooner rather than later in the draft. One guy I feel is making moves, now that he's healthy, is Nick Toon, the wide receiver from Wisconsin. His upside is really around Hakeem Nicks, who plays for the New York Giants. He's a good athlete. He can high point the ball, and he can get loose for you deep. He's not going to be an elite wide receiver in the NFL, but he's going to be pretty good. And really, even if he quote-unquote busts out, you've still got a big body who can go up and get the ball in the end zone, something the New York Giants could certainly use.
Michael Felder, back to you. Before we let you go here, give us your preseason top five power rankings. On paper right now, who are the teams that you really, really like at this point?
For me, and I'll start at the top, number one for me would have to be Southern Cal. You get a quarterback like Matt Barkley back, you get Robert Woods, Marquise Lee, those guys are just special. So I got to go with USC number one. Splitting hairs here, but I'll go Alabama over LSU because of the quarterback situation. Even though LSU as a team brings back more, they're breaking in Zach Mettenberger, and we still don't know what's going to happen with losing Reuben Randall. And then four and five, to me, I look at Oregon, and I got to slide them into four, because I think they are a quality ball club that really just, they've got a system and they're working their plan. And then at five, I know some folks don't like them as much as I do, but that's where I put the Georgia Bulldogs, because I think that is a team that is really set up to be special this coming up year. Their schedule shakes out for them pretty well. If they get Sanders Cummings back, whether it's the second or the third game, they get Brandon Smith back in the second or third game from their suspensions for their rest, I think they've got a chance to be really special, provided they beat Mizzou and they can win that SEC East.
Michael Felder from BleacherReport.com, new college football lead writer there. Michael, thanks so much for joining us on the program here. I encourage everybody to go out and check out your writing, which I know is going to be fantastic. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be sure to have you on again.
Thank you guys so much for having me on. Y'all have a good night.
All right. Let's take a quick break here again on the Average Joe Sports Show here on the Sports Geeks Radio Network. When we return, we'll switch from the gridiron to the hardwood. We'll talk a little college basketball. Yeah, there's that March Madness thing that's happening. I suppose we should probably get to that at some point. We'll talk a little NBA basketball as well. You don't want to miss it. That's coming up next.
Grant me power!
I'll make you fun size.
Behold my true form and despair!
The innocent shall suffer big time.
You are extremely freaky.
Yeah, pretty much.
There can be only one.
You cannot die, McCloud.
Guess so.
You have power beyond imagination. Use it well, my friend. Don't lose your head.
I must go.
Nature. Relaxing, isn't it?
Those clips are all taken out of context. You're just trying to make us look goofy and paranoid.
Hey, welcome back. It's the Average Joe Sports Show on the Sports Geeks Radio Network. Speaking of goofy and paranoid, Mike Schotte, Ethan Noroff joining me here on the phone line still. I'm Joel Cordes. Time to talk a little college basketball. Let's see. Mike, I'm going to throw this one to you first because you like to deal with the legal side of things, and Ethan will get your thoughts on it in just a second here too. Before we talk about the best games from the week, part of one of the biggest stories from the weekend was not only the fact that Kansas State lost, that was a possibility, even though Syracuse is certainly wounded with the loss of Fabio. But the bigger news for K-State was the fact that they had a player suspended, that would be Jamar Samuels, or at least ineligible to play. Really, they find that out just hours before the game itself. And now stories are starting to circulate that this might be over a couple $100 in meal money. I'm not exactly sure what's going on with this. Mike Schotte, it was clear to see that Frank Martin, the coach of K-State, was really broken up, not only by their loss, but by the circumstances that preceded their loss. Was this the right way to handle it? I mean, do you go the letter of the law and kick the kid out hours before the game, or do you wait until the next game and see what happens?
Well, I'm torn on this issue because it's pretty clear that this kid needed the money. I'm sure we could look back at his, past and see, even if he's had a troubled life, he's gotten stipends from the NCAA, he's getting a free education, et cetera, et cetera. And we could look and find where he's misspent money on, music or video games or clothes or whatever and say, well, just look at that. This is just another opportunity for a young kid wasting away his NCAA career on, extra quote-unquote benefits. But I truly do believe that this you know, these players are making as much money for the NCAA as they are getting back in quote-unquote education, many of whom don't even finish it because they're one and done these days. And, you know, it's hard to hear about all of these coaches getting, you know, $100,000 or more bonuses for getting to the NCAA tournament, or coaches like Shaka Smart get multi-million dollar deals after taking their team to the NCAA tournament. And then looking back at a kid who got a couple hundred bucks for food and saying, you know, this is the kid who's doing everything wrong. All of that being said, as much as I dislike the rules, they are rules and they should be adhered to by everyone, because there are kids probably out there who are needy and didn't take those extra benefits. So why should they be, you know, in a sense penalized for acting under the law, and these guys, you know, would skate free? Now, looking at this situation from every shape and form, this seems like a pretty harsh penalty. But looking back, would you rather simply not have this player and possibly take the chance at winning games anyway? Or do you want to have this player get to the tournament and vacate those wins later on down the road and have that be tainted? Really, it's six and one, half a dozen in the other. I think the NCAA did what it had to do, and I'm glad they did it before the games were played. But, man, a couple hundred bucks for food, it seems like a lot.
Ethan, would you have handled the Jamar Samuels situation any differently?
I think there have to be extenuating circumstances in a case like this. You know, as Michael so diligently pointed out, as he typically does, you know, it's about food. The kids got to eat. The coach was being honest. To declare him ineligible, you know, 20, 30 minutes before probably what he would have considered the game of his life, I just think it's heartbreaking, not only for him, but for his teammates. And how do you go into a game pumped up when you learn so soon before tip-off that arguably your best player is not going to play? How do you get pumped up for a game like that? I feel bad for these kids. I feel bad for Jamar Samuels. And I feel bad for the whole team. It's really a shame that it had to go down like this.
Let's talk about the games themselves, Ethan. Give me a couple of teams or games that you've really enjoyed, people who are jumping out and surprising you or taking care of business like you thought they would.
I think we have to start with NC State. You know, for them to get to this point is pretty impressive. They had a really good victory over Georgetown after, you know, they're going to be facing Kansas in the Sweet 16. A team that, you know, not many think that they could get past, but they're on a good roll right now, so what's stopping them? I think Michigan State is a team that has come out and really taken care of business. They scared a few people toward the end of the game today, and they let St. Louis back into things, but, you know, they're a really good team, and there's a lot that I like about them. So I think those are two teams that I've got my eyes on right now and see what they can do going forward.
I'm going to give some props to Indiana. Ugly win over VCU. In fact, really the only watchable portions of the game are the last final minutes, but that's the second round in a row that Indiana has really gutted things out. Baylor, of course, is taking care of business. People looked at their side of the South bracket and said, this is a team that should be able to get into the Sweet 16, maybe even the Elite Eight. And so far they have taken care of that in pretty resounding fashion. A little bit of a slow start against South Dakota, but a very complete game against Colorado the other day. Mike, who have you been keeping an eye on?
I think the clear winner of perhaps this entire tournament, if not the world in general, is the newspaper that put out the headline, Norfolk and Way, after Norfolk State took home a game in the opening round. I guess now is round two if you want to, you know, bastardize the entire history of the tournament. But taking home a win in round two, upsetting, I believe, Missouri? Or was it Duke? Either way.
It was Missouri.
Great win for them. Team, I was disappointed. Well, let's keep going positive. Jared Sullinger in the Ohio State Buckeyes came out, and especially Sullinger has looked revitalized. He's had a really poor season, and many, you know, had this, you know, we thought he should have come out for the draft last year, then he didn't, and now he's underwhelming. Is this guy going to be a complete, you know, fall off the map kind of bust in the NBA? And, you know, since the Big Ten tournament, he has been shining. And I think he came out today and was, you know, 2 for 2 from three-point range right away. He's just shown me a lot. So him specifically and just that entire Ohio State team. Aaron Kraft has been playing well as well. And then negatively, I have to just question what in the heck happened to the Michigan Wolverines. It might just be my fanhood poking through, but a team that was so hot from the arc just a couple weeks ago is now dead cold, losing in the Big Ten tournament and now to Ohio, not simply what they're calling Ohio State, which they usually do, but the actual Ohio Bobcats beating them in the quote-unquote second round of the tournament. A huge disappointment, and I wish I hadn't been keeping a close eye on them.
Put your fanhood away. That's gross. Now, Ethan, let's talk about the Elite Eight. My bracket is doing okay. The second round here has really slaughtered a bunch of things, but I still have a pretty decent shot at Sweet 16, Elite Eight. Give me the Elite Eight teams that you see making, and then we'll run down the list here too, Mike, in a second.
Sure. Well, I really like Kentucky and Baylor to meet in the Elite Eight. I like Michigan State. I thought Missouri would certainly go a lot further than they did, but looks like we're going to have a Florida-Marquette matchup in the Sweet 16. I like Florida there. Marquette's a nice team, but, hey, Florida's playing well, so keep the good times rolling. Kansas is another team that I like to reach the Elite Eight. Same goes for North Carolina, Ohio State. And I'm going to give the edge to Wisconsin over Syracuse. I think the Fab Melo is really going to hurt them against Wisconsin. The rebounding issue was on clear display against Kansas State, but they got some strong play from the perimeter and a lot of good stuff from Scoop Chardine. So we'll see what they're capable of doing. But I like Wisconsin to reach the Elite Eight there.
South and West look really, really good for me. Kentucky and Baylor, I can sign off on that. Michigan State, of course, is there. I'm going to go with Marquette instead of Florida, who is taking care of business against Norfolk State as we speak. So I'll go Michigan State and Marquette. Wisconsin, I see them beating Syracuse as well for exactly the reasons that you gave. I'll give Florida State the nod over Ohio State. And then really this is just the matchup I want to see. I'm not sure it can happen, but I want to see North Carolina and NC State in an Elite Eight appearance. That could go down as just one of those fantastically epic college basketball games. Mike, any that you disagree or agree on?
It sounded pretty good across the board. I really do like Kentucky to beat Indiana, as you guys have said. I like Wisconsin over Syracuse for the exact reason that Ethan said, that Wisconsin, for all of their faults, is always a good rebounding team, and that loss of Fab Melo is finally going to bite Syracuse, even though it almost bit them in round one. I like Ohio State to advance there. Over in the Midwest region, you know, I would love to see NC State beat North Carolina as well, but I think when all is said and done, North Carolina is going to advance there. Michigan State's going to have a hard time with Louisville, and the Izzo-Pitino comparisons and drawn-out conversation is going to happen. But much like you guys have said, I think Michigan State is going to take care of business there. If I have to root for one of these coaches, I'm certainly going to root for Tom Izzo. And then on the other side of that bracket, I like Marquette over Florida. Marquette is just one of those teams that everyone seems to underrate, and quite frankly, the Big East needs someone. So let's say it's Marquette.
All right, we'll take a quick break here on the Average Joe Sports Show. Of course, next week there will still be plenty of college basketball going on. We'll be able to talk about the Final Four and whatnot. For now, however, it's NBA time. Lots of trades this past week. Let's break down the deals and how they're panning out so far. Some of these players have not even reported yet and have not even played a single minute for their teams. There's a couple of guys, though, that have suited up. We can establish their value at the moment. Let's take a quick break here on the Average Joe Sports Show on the Sports Geeks Radio Network.
Finally, those capitalist pigs will pay for their crimes, eh? Hey, comrade,
what if he shot me in the face?
That's the risk we were willing to take.
And you choose to thank me by throwing a knife in my head?
There's no crying in baseball.
I want you to know that your father loves you both very much.
But he feels like a girl.
So did Martina Navratilova.
What were you doing exactly?
I was eating pop.
Putting cat filthy emptiness inside me? But it'll help.
You're going to need a bigger boat.
Average Joe Sports Show, Sports Geeks Radio Network, Joel Cordes, Ethan Noroff, Michael Schotte, and no conjunctions. Welcome back, everybody. Time to talk NBA basketball. There was plenty of trading during the week.
Mike, I'll let you run point here in just a second, but Ethan, I want to lead in with the trade in most distant memory at this point, but probably the one that's gotten maybe the most press. Milwaukee and Golden State swapping a couple of near all-star players. Andrew Bogut, of course, goes out to the Warriors, not healthy. Monte Ellis goes out to the Bucks. Yeah. Steven Jackson heading out to the Bay Area as well. You did not like this deal whatsoever. Just reading some of the articles that you had and your analysis on it, you were pretty passionate that this was not a good deal. Do you still feel that way, almost a week removed from it? And let's make sure we got our mics on. And now start over, Ethan. There you go.
I'll tell you why I still don't really like this move, and there's a couple reasons. For Golden State, it's a team that's been desperate for a center for the longest time. They signed Andre Spacman to a ridiculous contract and still owe him $9 million annually. They wasted $7 million on Kwame Brown, who they fortunately were able to include in the trade to Milwaukee to acquire Andrew Bogut. But this is a huge gamble. This is a guy who hasn't been able to stay healthy recently. His elbow is never going to be right. He's got some concern with his ankle injury that's going to keep him out for the rest of this season. I think it's a big roll of the dice for Golden State. Larry Riley said he'd rather have players than cap space. Well, can't you have both? Why can't you build a solid foundation? Stephen Curry has a lot of question marks around him and his ankle. And not only do they not keep Steven Jackson, whose contract situation was bad enough, but that team was so desperate to acquire a first-round pick that for some reason unknown to me, they willingly took back Richard Jefferson's inflated deal. They're not going to be players in the free agent market, so they're going to have to go with what they've got, and I don't think what they've got is good enough.
Yeah, it's crazy for me, Mike Shoddy, running point here from here on out. It's crazy for me that when this deal initially happened, our job is centered in San Francisco, and really it looked like a couple people from our home offices were going to jump off the bridge because they really thought they didn't get enough back for Monte Ellis. And then, personally, having a lot of friends in the Milwaukee area, the next day I found that most people were saying that in the Milwaukee area that they didn't get enough back for Bogut, that if Bogut gets healthy, he could hopefully be a good big, and they didn't get enough back for him. So this almost seems like it could potentially, at least from the fans' point of view, turn out to be a lose-lose deal because they're not quite sure how Monte Ellis is going to fit in Milwaukee, just as they weren't quite sure how he was fitting in Golden State. Joel, you've heard our negative connotations of the deal. Can you just throw a little sunshine at it?
Well, as people have said, and it's the biggest if Andrew Bogut stays healthy, he does block shots, he does rebound. They might have one of the best rebounding tandems of big men in the NBA between Bogut and Lee. Outside of Kevin Love and Nikola Pekovic, you won't find too many other power forward center combinations who will pull down more rebounds in that group. Both are good passers. Both can score the basketball. Bogut plays defense where Lee doesn't. That's not a bad combination to have, especially if Steph Curry stays healthy. But this reminds me of so many Warriors trios of the past. Tons of talent, but they never could put all of them on the floor at the same time. For Monte Ellis going to Milwaukee, I'm okay with that idea, especially because it gives them an insurance policy. And really, it tells Brandon Jennings, look, if you think you're going to leave us, we can move you at any point and get something. In some ways, they've gotten Jennings' replacement. Ellis can play both with Brandon and without him. And, Ellis has already suited up for them once or twice and dropped 20 points. So they needed offense in the worst way.
Let's move on to the trade that happened directly after that Ethan already mentioned a little bit. Then Golden State shipped Steven Jackson, who they acquired from Milwaukee, off to San Antonio to bring back Richard Jefferson, a draft pick. Joel, I'll shoot this to you first because I know you liked the deal for San Antonio. Evaluate this deal for me. How good of a deal did San Antonio get, and how hosed did Golden State get?
Well, I think the first-round draft pick and the amount of baggage that comes back with Steven Jackson, I don't think Golden State got hosed. I just think it's a really good deal for San Antonio in that they knew what they were getting with Richard Jefferson, and it wasn't what they expected a couple of years ago when they signed him. Both Jefferson and the Spurs have tried very, very hard with no bad feelings either side tried very, very hard to make that work, and Jefferson just did not fit. He had improved his corner three-point shooting, but his athleticism was not there. He was losing his starting job anyway, so they knew that they were getting a solid player. With Steven Jackson, you know that you have a big-shot guy. He's a little bit of a case, but he also is a much better defender. He's a versatile guy who can do more than Richard Jefferson does. And frankly, the Spurs just did not have that wild card guy heading into the playoffs. And I think every single contender needs somebody who's half crazy. And Steven Jackson provides that for them in the same way that Ron Artest gave the Lakers that added dimension a couple of years ago. And Jackson is done on his contract here when this is all said and done. I think he's got a year or two left. It's not a horrible deal for them, and I just think he gives them that fun dimension they were lacking. Plus, he's played for Popovich before, and if there's one coach in the league who's going to be able to get back to Steven Jackson, I think Popovich can do it.
Ethan, I feel like every time I've thrown you a question in the past 5 weeks, at least once you've brought up the Los Angeles Lakers. So this time, it's not just going to be speculation or rumor or whisper. It's going to be things that actually happened for the Los Angeles Lakers, and I think this should be an exciting moment for you. After the Los Angeles Lakers bring in their point guard that they desperately needed, Ramon Sessions, and also get a solid front court player in Jordan Hill. Of course, to do that, they had to get rid of Derek Fisher, who's been a stalwart for them, as well as Walton Nyanga. Overall, did the Lakers get better at the trade deadline?
I don't think there's any question that they got better. This is a better team than it was a week ago, and a big part of that is Ramon Sessions. As you noted, they desperately needed a point guard. There are questions about Sessions and Kobe Bryant coexisting in the same backcourt because Sessions does tend to play better with a ball in his hands, but I think he's really willing to adjust his game and fit whatever the Lakers need him to do. He's very excited to get into Los Angeles, to get into a situation where he knows he's going to contend, doesn't have to worry about making the playoffs every year, and he's going to be the starter, no question about it. Steve Blake might be starting now, but it's not going to take long for Sessions to overtake him as the starter there. There's just such a gap in talent between those two players. Sessions has got a player option on his deal for next year for $4.5 million, but even if he does opt out, the Lakers made this trade with every intention to have him in the fold long term. I think he's happy to be there. They're happy to have him, and it's going to be a marriage that works out. Most importantly, they got rid of Luke Walton's terrible contract. Luke Walton was making more than $5.5 million this year, slated to earn another $6 million next year. The team had absolutely no plans to use him in the near future. Got rid of Luke Walton, got rid of the mistake that was Jason Capono, who signed in the offseason, and brought back not only Sessions, but a really interesting athletic prospect in Christian Nyanga. And I think there's no doubt that Mitch Kupchak did a lot of good work with that deal.
We're going to take a quick break here on the Average Joe Sports Show. When we get back, we're going to finish up with the NBA trade deadline. You're listening to the Average Joe Sports Show right here on the Sports Geeks Radio Network.
Now's the time our sprockets been we dog.
Don't worry, I'm ready.
And now we may party.
I don't need no instructions to know how to rock.
What in Judas Rock and Priest is going on around here?
It's a big deal. Shut up and don't look at me.
Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
Don't nobody understand the words that are coming out of your mouth, man.
It's understanding that makes it possible for people like us to tolerate a person like yourself.
Unbelievable. That's the only way anything is expressed. These completely insane jokes.
Welcome back to the Average Joe Sports Show right here on the Sports Geeks Radio Network. Mike Shoddy, Ethan Noroff, and Joel Cordes talking a little NBA action with you this evening. And now, Joel, Ethan seems to really like this deal for the Los Angeles Lakers, bringing in Ramon Sessions, getting rid of Derek Fisher. And personally, I've always had a soft spot in my heart for Ramon Sessions as well. He played for the Timberwolves, a team that I spent some time covering up in Minnesota. He was a stalwart in every single video game I've ever owned having that had to do with the NBA. But I do have this feeling that when it gets to playoff time, if the Lakers are making any sort of run, they're going to miss that heady veteran presence of Derek Fisher. Are they going to miss Derek Fisher? And how bad does it look that he didn't even report to the Rockets?
Well, first of all, it looks very, very bad. The reports are now surfacing through ESPN and others that the Rockets and Fisher are working on a buyout, which, of course, begs the question, why give up Jordan Hill if you're just getting Fisher back? So you basically gave away Hill for practically nothing. I know there's a pick involved there. I like what the Rockets did in getting Marcus Camby. I don't like this aspect of their moves. They need a backup point guard right now with Kyle Lowry being out, so Fisher could play there. Fisher has done this before. He signed away with the Golden State Warriors after the Lakers' first repeat, and then was moved to the Utah Jazz. Well, then he had a buyout, basically, in Utah. Part of that was because his daughter was sick at the time, and he bounces back with the Lakers. So I think he's had his heart set on being there. It just might not be realistic to happen. Will the Lakers miss having a big shooter on the floor who can take that shot? Yes, they will. They're not going to miss the fact that Derek Fisher can't guard a chair right now. And Sessions, despite the fact that he's not a great defender, is still an improved player. He gets into the lane. I think they'll miss Derek Fisher only for nostalgic purposes, but not practical purposes.
Ethan, let's move a little bit north of L.A. and talk about the Portland Trailblazers. They blew things up at the trade deadline. Give me your reaction to their moves.
A lot of surprise. You know, I knew that the Blazers were going to make some moves. They had to. A team drastically struggling to meet expectations after a very, very solid start to the season. Nate McMillan being fired was really just the final stick of dynamite to that picture, but kind of knew that was coming with how the team had been playing and appearing to tune him out at times. The surprise to me is that neither Raymond Felton nor Jamal Crawford were moved, and those were the two players who were most heavily talked about as potential trade targets for other teams, and the Blazers were actively shopping. I think it sends a strong signal that this team is looking toward the future. Healing Gerald Wallace was all about that first-round pick that they got from New Jersey, which is only top three protected. That's going to net them a young impact player who comes at a cost-controlled price. Mehmet Okur's near $11 million deal is set to come off the books at the end of the season. This gives them cap space to sign an important restricted free agent in Nicholas Batum, who can now play his natural small forward position with Wallace gone. So this is acting GM Chad Buchanan saying, hey, we tried this season, it didn't work out, and we need to rebuild before we get stuck in mediocrity and we're wallowing between a playoff spot and a lottery spot. Meanwhile, years are passing us by without any real progress.
I'm going to jump in here real quick. Here's why I think Raymond Felton didn't get moved. His value is so low right now that I just have this inkling that Portland, when looking at the options of what they would get back, really said this guy can't play any worse and we're not going to contend this year, so let's keep him. Let's allow him to build some value. Yeah, he's on an expiring contract here coming up, but we can do a sign and trade if he establishes some value. If he doesn't, we let the guy walk. Then at that point, we're not out any money. Jamal Crawford at least has some value for them because somebody has to put the ball in the basket. And, you know, he actually has been playing fairly well. I was really surprised that Crawford didn't get moved to the Minnesota Timberwolves and that Beasley didn't get moved to the Lakers. But there again, Crawford is on one of those deals where he could opt out after this season. And the Blazers are looking at this as you know, there probably just wasn't enough value they could actually get back. It made more sense for them to hold on to that money and just let it potentially come off the books.
One move that I know Joel and I disagree with, because we actually talked about it the other night, is the three-team deal that sent Nene from the Nuggets to the Wizards, which sent JaVale McGee back to the Nuggets, and Nick Young went to the Los Angeles Clippers. Now, honestly, JaVale McGee has as much upside as anyone in the NBA, but hasn't been able to pull his head out of his butt the entire time he's been with Washington. Joel, you think that has to be at least a little bit a product of where he's been and where he might be going, or where he is going. Joel, convince me again why this wasn't just a horrible trade for the Denver Nuggets.
Well, on paper, Nene obviously is the more established player and is a fairly heady guy. He does not rebound well, however, but he is a good scorer and a guy who can play either the four or the five. Yet JaVale McGee is on a contract that's substantially less than Nene. they kind of had buyer's remorse, the Denver Nuggets did. They paid Nene a lot of money. He's an all-star caliber player, sort of, but he's not necessarily a franchise guy. George Karl is really buying into this idea that you can go 10 deep, 11 deep, and they don't have to be superstars, and he's going to get a chance to prove that now with bringing JaVale McGee back. McGee has upside, as you spoke about. I think it's a great financial move for them. It gives them more flexibility. And George Karl likes working with younger players. It didn't always used to be that way, but he's really changed a lot, it seems, in the last 5 years here. And I think when you look at the coaches that JaVale McGee has had in Washington, it's been a revolving door. He's been around a couple of other head case players like Andre Blatch. That certainly doesn't help the situation. Here he's going to come into a team that's young, but they're focused. They have a good coach who wants to reach out to players. You know, I can't think of more than maybe two or three other spots that would be better for McGee to have gone for his career than the Denver Nuggets right now.
Ethan, who was the clear winner in this three-team deal?
I really think this is an interesting deal. The Clippers took a very low-risk gamble on Nick Young. They didn't give up really anything to acquire him, but obviously the bigger pieces involved are JaVale McGee and Nene. I like the deal for Washington despite Nene being overpaid. I think they had to bring in a veteran leader into that locker room to really help John Wall's development. I think the Wizards are strongly going to consider using the amnesty clause on Andre Blatch in the offseason to free up some money and potentially making another move. They can work on a buyout with Rashard Lewis, even though he's owed nearly $24 million for next season, an unbelievable number for his production. Only around 10 of it is guaranteed, so perhaps they go that route. I think this is really says a lot about what they think about John Wall. They need a player who's going to be positive for his development, and I think Nene fits that description. I agree with Joel to an extent that maybe Denver had buyer's remorse, but I think this is more of a case of GM Masai Ujiri, who's one of the best in the game and isn't talked about enough, of really just selling on his stock when he thought the time was appropriate. I think Denver re-signed Nene in the offseason with every intent to trade him. I don't think that was ever very much in question. They have a really, really talented rookie in Kenneth Faried who can step right into minutes at power forward. And now with McGee in the fold, they have 2 to 3 months to decide whether or not they're going to give this kid a big, big contract in the offseason when he becomes a restricted free agent. He's asking for nearly $14 million a year, and that's a lot of coin to pay out to somebody who hasn't proven it on a consistent basis. But the potential is very real in McGee's game, and if he's surrounded around with the right players like he is in Denver with the right head coach and George Karl, I think this is a move that can make the Nuggets a lot better.
Joel, living down here in Orlando, it felt a lot like the Dwight Howard saga was over, and I think a lot of people said their thank yous to the power above when he signed that early termination opt-out, I guess they were calling it. Give me the latest, and is this Dwight Howard thing really over, or should the Orlando people still be worried?
Well, it buys Orlando time to potentially trade Howard again. So we will be back to this point in the off season. It's going to happen. It really, really, really depends on how the Magic finish out in the playoffs this year. Deron Williams has basically made it known that he will not do the same thing in New Jersey. He is going to become a free agent. And so what happens if Deron Williams does sign with Dallas, which I think he will at this point, unless New Jersey, I mean, the minute the offseason opens up, unless New Jersey can swoop in and somehow give Orlando a fantastic deal to pick up Dwight Howard, I think Deron Williams is gone. And if Williams goes to the Mavericks and the Magic have not, really held up their end of the bargain and they have a disappointing playoffs here, then all of a sudden you'll see Dwight Howard really trying to force his way out, but at least it will be during the off season. He may not have a lot of leverage then at that point, but it will also feed into his good guy image a little bit more in that he won't have to potentially be sulking on the floor and he'll avoid a lot of the media scrutiny that way too.
That's all the time we have for the Average Joe Sports Show this evening. Coming up next week, of course, we'll talk a little more NFL. we'll get back to the NBA and talk to maybe some players that didn't go on the move, and also start looking towards the NBA playoffs that are just around the corner. And, of course, we'll check into the NCAA tournament, that little thing that's going on over in those ranks as well. For Joel Cordes, for Ethan Noroff, this is Michael Shoddy. This has been the Average Joe Sports Show. Have a great week.
You can take away our phones and you can take away our keys, but you cannot take away our dreams.
That's right, because we're like sleeping when we have them.
What you've just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it. I award you no points, and may God have mercy on your soul.